Hey, everybody out there in the world of the internet. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. My name is Rob Couch, as you can see from my lower third. And welcome to Something from Nothing. This is our every other week Google Hangout, where we're talking to game designers about what they're working on and just kind of talk about design in general. So if everybody would please introduce themselves to the audience.
At once?
Anybody.
Okay, go on. I am Daniel Solis. I am art director by day, game designer by night. I'm on the internet, on danielsolis.com.
Yay!
All right, I guess I'll go next. I am Tori Neiman, designer of Alien Frontiers and a few other things, and I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. I'm Chevy Dodd. I am back. I am also from the internet.
Hey, I'm Jason Slingerland. I'm, I guess, also from the internet, but also the Building the Game podcast weekly with Mr. Rob Couch.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. You know, this is just kind of a free-form conversation here, you know. We don't really have a specific agenda, so if somebody wants to start, well, maybe I'll just start real quick and say that Jason and I spent most of this weekend at Grand Con up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and we had a great time, and we did a lot of playtesting of our prototypes that we've been working on, and that went fantastic. But this is not the Rob and Jason show, so Tori, let's start with you. What have you been working on lately?
Well, yeah, I've got a lot of different things that I've been working on. Mostly I've been working on PayDirt, which is a new design that's coming up hopefully sometime soon through Kickstarter and Crash Games. So that is definitely one of my priorities right now. Also been working on a game called Cut Purse, which is still in pretty early stages, but I'm still excited about that one.
Cool. Daniel, how about yourself?
What have I been working on lately?
Yeah.
Let's see. The ones I can tell you one that's bugging me. How about that?
Sure.
It's an espionage themed card game that is the mechanics are basically based on Liar's Dice, I've got a point now where it's like a solid design on its own, but it's still just a seed and it needs to have more granularity added to it. So that's kind of this interesting point where I have to stretch my own desires for elegance and kind of temper that with something that's a little bit more replayable and has some variety. Aside from that, I've got a bunch of other stuff too. Monsoon Market drafting game, got some little tiny things. Right now I'm working on this weird Viking game. Like I got a lot of stuff, but espionage is the one that's sticking its little nose in my business at the moment.
Cool. Chevy, what's on your plate?
Apparently I'm just tweeting really bad links right now. I don't know. I've got Protospiel Milwaukee coming up this week, and I was hoping to test Hedeby a little bit because the publisher told me they wanted it in Thanksgiving time frame. But then they emailed me last week and asked him if I could have it to him by Tuesday. So I kind of got in this rush to get it done. And so I've got this show coming up, and I really don't know what I'm going to be showing. I have this racing game that I designed from the last Protospiel Milwaukee, and I'll probably take it with me because I feel like it needs a little something, and maybe I can get some ideas there. Other than that, I've kind of got this dungeon crawling tile laying thing that we talked about last time on the show. I've been kind of tweaking that a little bit. Might show up with that. But really, Hedeby's been the focus for quite a while now.
Cool. Great. Jason.
Yeah, as you said, we were at Grand Con together this weekend. I got to do a lot of playtesting on Sandbox Showdown, which was cool. And then the game I'm working on a lot more right now is the Transylvania Trading Company, which we got to do one playtest on. But that playtest was awesome because it let me cut 70 cards out of the game after the playtest, which felt really good because it was a little heavy for a card game for me. So yeah, it was great meeting all the people and talking to the designers and stuff. It was a really good time.
Cool. So kind of what we're doing here is to talk about what we're having trouble with and try and bounce ideas off each other. So who wants to present us a problem that we can try and work out?
I can toss it out.
Sure.
So I don't know if anyone else has this problem. So I've got this game, and I'm a very like reductive designer. I like to take things away, and that's my usual solution to things. Like just take away until something is just finally really polished and solid and balanced. But because this game is it's actually for a client, it's something where I think they want something a little bit with stuff like variable player powers, some different subsystems. So I can go into more detail on it, but when you are faced with a situation where you make a game that's just too light, too small, how do you add nuances and texture to it without just making it a bunch of cruft and keeping the elegance that you already have?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So going back to my Hedeby game, that exact thing happened to me. Like I had this idea, and I thought it was going to be kind of grand, and then I played it, and it was kind of like, well, there's almost nothing going on here. You know, this thing that I saw in my head didn't happen. And so I started just kind of thinking about how I could add an additional, you know, thought process or an additional layer, and then that happened, and that didn't really help, and then let's add a little bit more, and then you kind of get to this point where now there's like seven different things going on, and none of them really make sense together. And so then you start the trimming process. So, well, let's start cutting stuff out. And I don't know, like, I think it's just, it's an experience thing of knowing, like, once you've tried so many different things with so many different designs, you kind of get this feeling that, okay, if I've got this flat kind of drafting mechanic, maybe I need to add in some sort of something better than just set collection. Maybe I need to have some sort of spatial element, or, you know, it just kind of works out. And then ultimately, asking other people, I think, is the real this is where like, you know, having a design partner kind of comes into play, is just asking somebody else. I've got a review going up this week from Antoine Balza about The Little Prince, and I'll kind of spoil it here, but I went and talked to Bruno Cathalo when I bought the game, and he told me it's all Antoine's game. He did all the work. And I said, yeah, okay, you know, whatever. So I went and talked to Antoine about it, and Antoine said, no, he's way too modest. But what the game was first was just this flat drafting game, much like any other Balza drafting game. It's a set collection. We're going to draft, and then we're going to score, and then we're going to draft, and then we're going to score, and then the game's over. And he said, you know, there just wasn't anything unique going on. And so he handed it off to Balza, or I mean to Bruno, and Bruno said, you know, this is great and all, but why don't we make it about trying to form this little planet, and, you know, so you've got this little tactile element, and all of a sudden they had the ability to add in the drafting of the scoring mechanism, and suddenly it opened the game way up. Now you've got the same flat drafting mechanic, but you're also drafting how you score, and completely changes the game. Like, suddenly it's just ta-da. And, you know, Antoine told me it was like 2 weeks after Bruno said, why don't we try this, 2 weeks later the game was done. And, you know, I think just leaning on other people, other designers, is a huge key. Okay, I took up way too much time. Sorry.
Well, that's good.
It was way too much.
Tori, I'm curious about your thoughts, because you design... What I really like about Alien Frontiers, and honestly, I feel like the games that I design are very helium. They're very light things, very much filler games that I think, you know, take 5 minutes, 10 minutes, that kind of thing. And that's sort of my niche. So designing something that's bigger, that's more substantial, like Alien Frontiers, that is something that's really much more outside of my scope. And I'm curious, like, how you can make these large games without making them feel like they're just cumbersome.
That's an excellent question, and I don't know. I'm not sure how that happened, but my two sort of instincts with that are, first is, you know, I loved how Alien Frontiers turned out, but part of the idea from the beginning is you start with something small, and the complexity is something that just builds throughout the game. And that's something you see in a lot of games, especially worker placement games, where you can get more workers. So you start with something very simple, and that allows you to scale up over time. But a lot of the questions, design questions for Alien Frontiers came back to what makes sense thematically and what works in a competitive game. So those two elements are the balance between those two elements is definitely where I see a lot of the complexity coming in. And, you know, in a real life situation, as much as space exploration with rockets and solar planets is realistic. Where does where do these things happen? And how does that work within a game? Now that's definitely easy to say and hard to do, which is, you know, how I like to do things. But the other side of it is this idea that, and this is something that I've run into myself when I'm designing a game, and I want it more complex and I want it more, you know, more stuff in it. I take this approach of just adding more stuff and along the same sort of line. Well, we have some of this, let's add more of this. And that never works, in my opinion. That never, ever works. What works is going in another direction. If you have something that works, go into the y-axis, into another direction to find more game space. Not just by adding more of the same, but by adding something different that might give it more depth. But I can't think of an incredibly good example with that, except for in Alien Frontiers, adding the planet that we were colonizing was actually something that came in, you know, and later in the design phase when I was feeling like, you know, this dice mechanic is great, and this rolling and placing is great, dice as workers is awesome, but we need something more to it, and that's where we came up with the planet colonization aspect, which is definitely something that I feel like paid off.
Awesome. We have a couple Twitter questions if you guys want to field them.
Sure. Yeah, great.
The first one we have comes from TC Petty, of course, and he asked, do we work well with solid deadlines? Do you find that publisher pressure is a good thing? Daniel, I bet you have some insight on publisher pressure, huh?
Yeah. Not so much about game design, but yeah. My day job is as an art director and layout guy for a couple different companies now. My biggest job right now is I'm the creative director, art director for the Firefly role-playing game. So that's like a lot of deadlines stacked up on top of each other, kind of staggered. And having to coordinate, you know, about a dozen different artists, making sure that their schedules are on time, making sure that they line up with the time it takes for Fox to approve different manuscripts and layout things, managing all that. It's I'm used to it just because I came out of the advertising business, which moves at a very rapid pace and sometimes can turn just completely 180 depending on a client's whims or if there's suddenly availability for an ad buy or whatnot. I'm used to that kind of like time scale, but doing it for game design, I don't know how I would do it because so often it takes such an unpredictable length of time to make sure a game is fully properly developed. It's like sometimes it goes really fast, sometimes it just takes, you know, 2 or 3 years, like you have to build the ball. I don't know how I'd handle it. Does anyone else have any ideas?
Well, I mean, just this week is the first time I've ever had this publisher pressure, because like I said, it was literally like Wednesday. I got this email like, if I get you an address today, can you have this game in our office by Tuesday? And I'm like, I thought I had 2 more months to work on this. You know, like, I think I can. The question is, do you want to see the version I'm going to have to you next week? You know, But I didn't lose sleep over it because I'm, you know, this publisher has given me the confidence that they're confident in me, which really made it, you know, made me kind of feel good. They're like, we want it now. All right, fine, here. But I got nothing. Tori, do you? Do you have anything about pressure?
No, actually. Not really. Not in any real sense. You know, Alien Frontiers was my first design, and I went to Clever Mojo with that. And my other designs I've been working on, you know, pretty continuously, you know, since then. So no real experience with pressure in that sense. And I just can't imagine it being a good thing because my creative process is so all over the place. And, you know, whenever I have the ideas, when it gets done. Now, there's some other factors that go into that, but I just can't imagine working well, doing my best work under a deadline pressure.
Cat.
And cat, yes.
I'm sorry, that's unprofessional. Welcome. That won't happen again.
Your cat is now from the internet. What, Tori, TC wanted to know if you started with something bigger with Alien Frontiers. Was it a bigger idea? Did you have a backstory, or was it just a purely mechanical thing?
The backstory of Alien Frontiers is actually kind of embarrassing. I started Alien Frontiers because I was reading on Board Game Geek, like you do during the day.
What are you talking about?
And I came across a description of Kingsburg, and I was like, "Ooh, this sounds like a very cool game. I would love to play this game." And I formed this idea of what Kingsburg was from about a two-line description of it. Somebody said, "You roll dice, and there you're like your workers, and that's it." And I was like, "Oh, that sounds cool." And so then I was watching this video review of Kingsburg, and I'm like, that's not at all what I imagined this game to be like. I mean, this is a cool game. This is totally different from what I imagined. And so I got to thinking, I was really bummed out that I couldn't play the game that I was thinking of. So I said, I guess I'll just make that game. And then I made that game. And that's the story. But, you know, from a design perspective, I started with the idea of the dice as workers and generating resources and leveraging those resources into victory points. And as I mentioned, then from there I went into the area control aspect with the map of the planet, and that naturally went into the idea of these different sections of the planet having different abilities, and that was that. At that point, we knew it was like, okay, yep, this game's basically done. We just got to tweak it, we got to balance it, and there we go.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, you know what, Daniel? Can you give us a little more information about the game that you're trying to get some more complexity into? Because that's actually something that I have a design that I really like the theme and I really like the kind of the core concept of it. But I feel like that core concept, that core mechanic, is just kind of, it works, but it's too simple. It's too empty. And I need to get some more stuff onto that. So maybe if you can tell us more about what you're working on, and we can talk about some details. And
I can do it really quick. So first off, has everyone played Liar's Dice?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Then you? Okay. All right. Cool.
Sure.
So
I'm familiar with it. I don't think I've actually played it though.
Well, so the basic mechanic is that. Let me just back up. So basically, it's one of these like half kind of sort of micro games. It's a small deck of cards, 36 cards. Each card represents a spy, and every player is a spy tracker that is trying to figure out the spy activity around the world. And every spy has a unique combination of a city that they're in, one of three cities. New York, London, Moscow, one of three organizations they're working for, either the agency, the bureau, or command, and they're either a tough, a face, or a hacker. And so they're all unique combinations of this, and basically it works out that because that there's nine of each of those attributes, and there are unique combinations of each, it works out to about, I think, 27 unique spies. The rest of the deck is five mercenaries, which are basically wild cards that that can represent any one of those attributes. And the remainder, the four remainders, are traitors that are kind of like anti-wilds, or like the opposite of wilds, that they would reduce they cancel out any other cards. So here's how it works, basically. You deal out a hand of cards, of five cards each, to each player, and on your turn you make a bid, essentially saying that you guess that the minimum, that there are at least three spies that are in everybody's hands. And basically you're looking at the hand of cards that you have, and these are your contacts, and they're your informants that are telling you a little bit of information that's about the spy activity around the world. And so that if you see like two in your hand, it's a good safe bet that someone else has at least one more. So you can feel pretty confident saying, I think there's at least three hackers out in play. Then you choose the next player to make the next bid, and they can raise that number, or they can raise and change the attribute. So, for example, they could respond, I think there are seven spies in Moscow, and they choose the next player who has to respond to that. Everyone can be chosen only once per round, and then that cycle can renew again in whatever order as players choose. And once someone makes a call, that is, they actually say, "All right, I'm going to call that," and basically, everyone reveals their cards. Then you find out what the actual number of that thing is. So, say for example, you had bid that there's spies in Moscow. You look around the table, look at everyone's cards. If the number is greater than that, then the bidder wins that duel basically, and the loser will lose one from their hand limit. Basically, one of their contacts has gone underground. Or if the number was actually less than what the bid was, then the person who made the call won, and so the loser in that duel would lose one contact. So basically, the stakes are reducing your hand size every single time. And then there's a small little twist where if you say spot on, it's basically a confirm. If you think that number is exactly right, then it's sort of like this big massive attack. Like if you confirm, and you're right, then everyone else loses one from their hand limit. And then everyone shuffles back up. You deal a new hand of cards based on the new revised hand limit based on that duel, and you keep on going. It takes a while for the first elimination, but once the first elimination happens, then the rest of the game goes pretty quick. So it is an elimination game, but it goes pretty fast. And when you're resolving the number, resolving the bid, all of the mercenaries count as +1, and all the traitors count as -1. So because you know that there's only 9 of any particular attribute, 9 is this very important tipping point when you make a bid. Because if you say that there's 9 of something, that's the absolute limit that it could possibly be, barring the presence of any mercenaries or traitors. If you go above that, then it gets really, really sketchy. And so that's all I have at the moment. It's a fairly simple, straightforward bluffing game with some simple stakes. I don't have any other nuance to it. I don't have any thematic changes based on, like, if you've bid, like, it doesn't mean anything different than if you've bid hackers than if you've bid Moscow or if you bid agency or what have you. And there's no greater stakes if you bid a high number than a low number either. Those are things that I've been exploring to add a little bit of complexity without augmenting the elegance of the core system. But as it stands, I'm not quite sure which direction to go. Whew. All right. Does that make sense? Sorry.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned.
Sounds like a great game.
That sounds like a lot of fun just the way it is. But you mentioned possibly variable player powers. Like, was something that you considered possibly adding? Is that correct? To the spies?
Yep.
I mean, what if it was something as simple as each spy has something unique about them, right? And that doesn't come into play until if I call you out, right? I say you're wrong, and I'm right that you were wrong. I get to pick one of the spies that fits that criteria and place them in front of me, and they stay there in play then, and that spy could have some sort of effect, right? Like some sort of minimal effect that, I mean, I have no idea what that minimal effect would be, but vice versa, if I call you out and I'm wrong, in addition to the penalty that I'm going to get, the person, the bidder who was right, would get to do that. That it seems like that would encourage people to call people out, because, you know, you want to be able to win to get that in play, to give yourself a bonus for rounds going forward. So just a thought. I love variable player powers, so.
Yeah, and they're the hardest thing for me to design. I tend to be in that mode of a light filler game where there's no variable player powers. Things like parade, guillotine, bell of the ball. You know, every player is equal, and gradually they build up different things. But that's certainly a way to go. So as if you win a duel and the stakes are that they lose one from their hand limit, that can be easily represented by just taking that card. And that's just one less card in the economy also. That's interesting.
Yeah, another way to add some more complexity, more layers, would be to have each, you mentioned that there's no differentiation between the hackers and the face and the brute. But to give them each like a thing that the hacker does, a thing that the brute does, a thing that the face does, and it, you know, before the guessing of what cards people have, everybody has to plays one of their cards, and it's no longer in their hand, it's no longer in the set of cards that are available, but it has an ability. So maybe the face allows you to look at one card from somebody else's hand, or the hacker allows you to look at people's other things that are in the game, just to make things a little bit more interesting and for you to have something to do with those cards besides the guessing element. But again, this may be getting away from that elegant element.
Is there a way to maybe call in a hit on somebody or call out an assassin to kill somebody to change the numbers after everyone's done bidding?
Entirely possible. One of the tricky things that I've had actually in this case is that I have made a very public declaration that I do not design games with violent themes.
Okay.
Which is complicated because I was hired to do a game about espionage, and so I'm trying to find a way to make a game about espionage that does not necessarily imply assassination.
Sure.
So like I'm entirely cool with, thematic tweaks that make things, saying a contact goes underground is relatively innocuous to some extent, but yeah, sure. I mean I'm entirely cool with mechanical things that do interesting things. I just got to figure out thematic reasons for them. But,
sure. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, that's just where I'm at right now. I think Tori mentioning adding the planet. This could be this could lead to nowhere, but it's kind of interesting. One of the things I was thinking about was as you play there are a row of cards in the middle of the table that each represent one of those suits, that the three cities, the three types of spies, the three factions. And as you make a guess regarding one of those things, you claim that card. And in doing so, that could have a mechanical effect and give other players a reason possibly to make a bid on that attribute, even if they don't believe that there is a higher number of that attribute in play at the moment. They just don't want you to get whatever benefit there is for having that at the end of the round.
That sounds like a very cool idea, and I could see that maybe as a way to reclaim a lost contact. Again, adding that extra sort of direction to go in, and so that the things that you're bidding aren't only based on what you know or what you think other people might know, but also on the benefit that you want to get by making that specific bid. So, I think that's a really good idea. I think it's definitely a place to explore.
Hooray! It's solved. Yeah. So I think given that, I think the next direction I'll go then is I'll work out what powers those could possibly be. And what's nice is that right now the way it works out is that when a round ends, there's only really two people who are involved. It's the last bidder and the caller, and everyone else is kind of like out of the loop in that conflict. But if everyone is still holding on to a card that represents whatever it is they previously bid in that round, they still have a stake in the outcome to some extent. Like they've got their own little piece of the pie before the round ends, and that's kind of it gives everyone something to do, I think. So I think I'll go with that.
Cool.
Yep. Thanks.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. That's what we hope to do here.
Yeah, just remember the old adage, though. We fix things when we're talking about them, but you break them when you play with them again. So get out there and break that one and see
it's
what
true.
Happens.
So true. So, what's Tori? What are you working on? What's your problem? I'm curious about what your problems are.
Well, my problem is just it seems like every idea that I have, I'm like it always comes back to Alien Frontiers because that's what I'm known for right now, and that's the game that's actually in print right now. What it always just comes back to, wouldn't people just rather play Alien Frontiers rather than this new game? And it comes like, yes, but. So that's really the stressor for me right now, is trying to come up with something that I feel is actually worth playing. For my current game that I'm designing, working on, called Cut Purse, it's a game about cut purses, pickpockets, stealing from medieval merchants and commoners and whatnot. And what I love about the idea is that there's, at least in this stage of prototyping, which there's always an asterisk, at this stage in prototyping, there's actual drawstring bags that you will dip into to take things out of the target's purses. And so they're actual literal purses that you are reaching your hand into and taking stuff out of. And I love this idea, and I have this fun press your luck mechanic where you can keep taking stuff out as long as you want, but if you draw two of the same things, they've caught you, and you have to dump the goods and run away. And so this is a lot of fun, and it's a lot, you know, it's a very good press your luck kind of a thing, but the downside is it's extremely random. There's you know, just things that shouldn't work, people making really stupid choices. Like, yeah, I'm going to keep going for the fourth type of thing. Oh, I got it. Let's go back for the fifth type of thing. And everyone at the table is like, don't do it. It's not going to work. And then it works. And that's great. But the current way that things are balanced out with the different scoring mechanisms, it just feels really, really random. So is there a way you can do a press your luck game that's not, you know, doesn't give that feel of no strategy?
I think so. I do.
Yes.
I have a game right now that I put it on the Game Crafter just simply because it's going to be a difficult game for a smaller publisher to manufacture, and most of the bigger publishers are kind of over, like just simple dice games at this point. But I wanted to take a dice game. There's seven dice. That's basically it. And have that push your luck dice game, but I wanted it to be something more than just zombie dice where you're just rolling and trying to get a high score for the turn and then passing the dice, because that seems kind of flat to me. Mm-hmm. So in my game, you've got three soldiers storming this bunker. In the version that's on the Game Crafter, it's called Leathernecks 43. So we are Marines, because I'm a Marine, storming the bunker and trying to knock it out. So I decided there was three soldiers running up this beachhead, and that's what you're attempting to roll the dice for. The game ends once somebody gets to the end of this bunker, you know, which is 15 spaces, basically. If you score 15 of any one of your soldiers, the game will end. And then whoever's the furthest ahead in each of those tracks gets to score a 10 bonus points. So not only are you having this goal of just trying to roll the most number of whatever symbol, but you have to kind of balance it between the three different categories based on what your opponents are doing. And I've played it with a lot of people who have said, wow, this is like, you know, it's about as pressure luck as you can possibly get. There's really no decisions with the dice as far as, do I keep these, roll those? I mean, there is, but there's not like there's card play or anything where you can be like, ha-ha, I get to do this. It's just simply dice. But having that little interaction takes it like just a nudge forward of the games where you just roll dice, score, pass the dice. Because now we're kind of, it's a competition that's actually physical as opposed to just on paper, and I think it adds a lot to any kind of game like that. And to go a little further with that, so the game that I just keep talking about, my Viking theme game, it starts off with you rolling five dice, and it's completely random, and you don't get any rerolls, nothing. At the start of the game, you get two little chits that you can use to roll a couple of dice, but that's it. But as the game progresses, as you roll your dice and you get resources and you buy things, those things that you buy help you tune the dice in later turns. And so by the end of the game, the dice are still a part of the game, but you almost have control over them. Not exactly. I've tried to keep it so that the dice don't ever become irrelevant. But you can get to the point where, you know, the dice are completely manipulated by the end of the game, and you've gone from having, you know, being at the mercy of the dice to being in control of them and hoping and helping, you know, them helping you build your engine. So in your case, like drawing chits out of a bag, I love chit games. Mm-hmm. Scallywags is a chit game at its heart. It is a chit pull. But doing it out of a bag, what are the games that have the where you dump the different colored cubes in the tower?
Wallenstein?
Is that Wallenstein?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's the only thing I could think of. Like, if you could tune the bag,
right,
instead of it just being like a random draw. But I don't know how you would do that thematically, because it would seem like you would have to want to tune it each time you draw, which would mean you're dumping the bag back out and trying to reset it up.
Everybody's talking at once. Sorry.
Well, my first thought was that, you know, if you're a cut purse, if you're a pickpocket, you know, you're looking for a good mark, right? You're walking through the crowd, you're looking for a guy that you think is going to be a good mark. So it seems to me like maybe you would have a card that would identify like a set number of items that would be in his purse, and then a set number of random things that would get thrown in there too. So for every challenge or every stage, you would draw that card, you would pick out the specific things that would be in that purse, and then you randomly throw some other stuff in there too, and then you have then you go for it. And then as you're drawing things out, you think, okay, well, I know how many of each of these things are in here, plus a couple random ones, and now I have to decide from there. Maybe that's a route to take.
Yeah, that's actually hitting on some of the elements that are already in the design. Maybe I should explain things a little bit more completely. But there are six different targets within the game, and they are set like individuals, and they have set compositions of their purses that are set at the beginning of the game. And as the game progresses, there are random events that may add new chits to certain pedestrians, as they're called, within the game. So that you have to keep track, okay, so he's stolen two silvers from this guy, but the random event added a gold back to his bag. So I know, so there's two less silver, but there's plus one gold. So trying to keep track of all those things is one element of the game that adds a little bit more skill into the mix. And there are cards that you do pick up during the game that make stealing from certain people harder or easier, or give you certain modifiers in certain situations. So there is a little bit more to it, but being able to be in a position where you can set things up, I don't know. To me, it's sort of this battle in the game that I'm working with is this balance between it being, you know, this press your luck game, and between it being something that you can have some strategy with and have some forethought with, and it's not just let's see what I pull out of the bag, and the person who pulls the most gold cubes wins. But that's striking that balance is really the tricky thing for me.
Hey Tori, when you're pulling, do you only pull one at a time always?
Yes, always. It's always one at a time.
And your problem is that people are able to get on these streaks where they just get a ton of stuff because they're pulling one at a time and they don't hit that condition.
Right. Well, there's a couple of factors with that. That is one of them. Probably what it comes down to is that there's so many random factors. There's the what you're pulling out of the bag. There's the random cards that you're getting. There's the random events that come up. That's three different random factors that go into the game that might, to a lot of people that I've played it with, they feel like, well, I'm not making a whole lot of meaningful choices because of these three different random factors that are happening within the game.
Well, I don't know about the other two, but it seems like one of the things that you could tweak is making each draw increase at a linear rate. So at the first draw, you're only drawing one. Second draw, you're drawing two. Third draw, you're drawing three. And if you draw the condition that ends your streak, then you don't get what. Then you still get the penalty, and you don't get whatever it is that you drew a lot of. But it seems like that would speed up. If there is a streak, it would speed up the streak. So you're not spending a lot of time on that streak. But also,
right.
It might increase the likelihood that you're going to break that streak too, if I understand correctly. The other thing that I kept on thinking of is that if you hit the same target multiple times, that seems like you increase the heat that you're drawing to yourself. And so that may be a thing that is in your game already, I'm sure.
That's interesting that there was that element in a certain earlier version of the game. I ended up getting rid of the game, that element, just because if you hit the same guy multiple times, because there's a finite amount of stuff in his purse, if you've got the good stuff out, he's got pennies in his purse anyways. You don't want to hit him again. So it became a sort of self-balancing thing, which I thought was pretty interesting. Mm.
I kind of like the idea of drawing like successively more things. And what if it, you know, what if you have a streak breaker in the bag? So it's like, you know, if you draw two of X, your turn's over. Period. And so if you're drawing four, you know, you maybe stop at three because you don't want to run that risk of screwing it up.
Right, and that's another thing that we had my playtesters had thought of is that if you're pulling stuff out of someone's bag, maybe you could just replace it instead of just making there less and less stuff in the bag. You replace it with these cubes indicating that you pulled out nothing from their purse. And I thought that was a fun idea, but in initial theory designing, I was like, well, it really sucked to just pull out a big handful of nothing from a purse. Really don't want to have a situation where somebody wastes their whole turn just pulling out nothing. Well, it's been more interesting than that.
You could still make it useful in the sense that it's useful in the long term. It's not so great drawing stuff, but I could see it thematically being something where that allows you to have an alibi. That you've drew what I don't have anything. It's like someone catches you, but you've drawn nothing. And I don't know. Maybe that doesn't work.
Well, that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea, because there is not with being caught so much, but with if you get too far ahead, the other players have an opportunity to try and steal from you because you have your own drawstring purse.
Oh,
so
wow!
They can go back and steal stuff from you, which is fun, and I love that element of the game. But it's also it also really, really sucks when you've worked really hard to make sure that you have that full set of document tokens, and then on the very last turn, the last guy's like, oh, I'm going to steal that last document from you, and because you've stolen a lot of documents, we've got a really great chance of doing that. But if there were nothing cubes, and you did pull the nothing cubes, storing those in your own purse would be great, because that means that people are going to be less likely to actually pull useful stuff from you.
Yeah, there you go.
So maybe that's I should go back to that idea. I never thought of putting it actually back into your own purse, but that's an interesting idea. Or it could just be pocket lint. We just call it pocket lint.
There you go.
Sure.
Tori, I've got a question. You were talking about them being, I assume they're supposed to be like coins you're pulling out, but you mentioned that you were using cubes. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's more of just I had a lot of cubes of different colors.
Right.
When I was prototyping, so that's
A thought would be, especially piggybacking on Daniel's idea, which was awesome, of successively drawing more things, what if they're all coins, but there are slight tactile differences between the denominations or types of coins? So when you first draw a coin, it'd be pretty easy to feel in to get like, oh, this has three bumps, it's probably a gold coin. But as you're drawing more and more, it's going to get harder to tell. But it still would help you decrease some of the randomness, because if you're doing a good job tactically, tactilely feeling what's in there, you have a better chance of getting good stuff out.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I was resistant to give that a try. Well, most of all, because it's hard to prototype.
For sure.
In a real way, it seemed to be one of those things that once people get good at playing the game, they're going to be able to feel every single coin, and then it's not going to be a challenge anymore. You're going to be able to cherry-pick, everything. And do you really want to sit there with the guy who's going to be like, put his hand in the bag, feel one coin, push it to the side, feel the next coin, push it to the side? And I just made the choice of, you know what, let's not do that. Let's just keep it on tactile.
Fair point. Yeah. That makes sense.
I mean, if you did have a tactile element, it wouldn't necessarily need to signify just one denomination of a thing. You could have two good things and a really, really bad thing that are the same shape. So you could, and even if you are good at tactile stuff, you could still be taking a risk. It could still be a factor.
That's okay.
I see what you're saying. On a less granular scale. And at one point I had something like that. But now bringing in this idea of there being tokens that are literally worthless. I have some things that are almost worthless, but things that are literally worthless.
We have a question from Twitter. The Flying Sheep had a suggestion about what about just getting rid of NPCs altogether, and you're only ever taking from other people, and so. I think that would help kind of tune each person's purse. If, two people target one guy and take some good stuff, then he obviously has less stuff. I don't know if that would help at all. So that was interesting.
It's definitely interesting. It feels like that would be a really antagonistic game.
Yes. Direct conflict.
If you went that way, because right now what you have is a very like Euro game in the beginning, and then it sounds like it leads up to the showdown into the last rounds. That's what it sounds like anyway. If you were to just cut straight to that showdown, you could still have this outlet for that stress by having a central attacks or something, where everyone draws a random thing out of their bag and pays it into this general pool, and that's like the Thieves Guild tax or something.
Yeah, currently there's a random event where, well, there's a mechanic where by taking certain actions and by trying to steal from certain people, you are moving into the light. So you're skulking in the shadows most of the time, but if you choose to move into the light to hit these higher value targets, the nobleman is always fully in the light, so you have to go into the light to get him. But that exposes you and makes you less capable of stealing in future rounds until you take some time and skulk back into the shadows like the scum that you are. There is a random event where the person who's most in the light gets hit, and basically they get shaken down by the police, and they have to bribe the police to avoid losing all their hard-earned, hard-stolen goods. Having that, reversing that a little bit and hitting it like everybody except the person most in the shadows, I think would be an interesting thing as well, so that everybody's attacked instead of just one person paying off the cops.
Yeah. What if instead of stealing coins or stealing like jewels, and every now and then you can skip your turn to go to the fence to sell your jewels, like bank some money? Is that something that could be helpful? So you give up the opportunity to steal on this turn to just try and basically save what you got.
That's an interesting idea.
But you're going to take a loss on that. And the more stuff that you can sell to the fence at one time, the more profit you're going to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're lowering your overall points, but you're making it so that those points can't be stolen from you by the other guys. That's an interesting idea. I'll have to playtest that some, because that's definitely that could definitely be, you know, an element. There is an element of increasing your overall skill. The idea is that you're paying the old master thief for lessons, and that increases your overall skill and makes you able to hit those higher value targets more consistently. But he takes some money from you, and after you get really good at it, to teach you the higher arts, he takes even more money from you. And that's an element where in the game where you're trying to, you know, risk reward. Okay, how long is the game going to last? Because the end is a little bit variable. Do I spend a lot of money to get really good at thievery, or do I just not do that and just rely on the cards that I'm going to draw?
Okay, cool.
Tori, this game sounds awesome.
Yeah, sure does.
Yeah, I like this. I am a fan of chit bowling, so I'm all about this game already.
All right. Well, cut first. I think I'm going to put it on Kickstarter tomorrow. All right.
Done.
Cool.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, if you do the sales guy, then your bad things could be like glass gems, and so maybe you get kind of penalized for selling fake gems, and so that could be your thematic tie-in for the bad stuff.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Having something that creeps up to punish people who are going for that option.
Yeah. So you go to the fence, and the fence is like, no, you gave me some bad crap last week, so you're getting less today, or something like that.
That's cool. Yeah, definitely fun stuff. Yeah, what I like about this game is that, like, every time I play it with my playtesters, they're like, oh, I've got like 16 ideas about how this game could go.
Yeah.
And that's great, but it's also like really stressful, because you're like, which one of those ideas didn't I listen to that's going to come back later and be the way that I should have been developing this game? So
that's crazy. That's really good. That's a good problem to have, because even just here, we're all coming up with so many different ideas, because it's an exciting combination of theme and actual mechanic. That it just really sings. I think it's a good sign.
I definitely agree. It was one of those things. I was dealing with this game for a while and different ways of doing it, and I came up with one prototype, and it was not working like it does. Does anybody else have this problem? Maybe we should take this conversation in this direction, where you have this idea of exactly how a game is going to play, and you make a prototype and play it, and that's not at all how it works?
Yeah.
Happens a lot, though.
Okay, I'm glad that's not just me, because that happens all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess. So it's unexpected emergent behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's always funny about that is I've had that happen several times, including the game I was just trying for the first time with the prototype yesterday, and as it starts to happen, you think, how did I not think of that? This is so obvious that this was going to go wrong. I mean, you just feel like such a dunce because you thought, like, on turn two, this is obvious. This is not what I expected, and this is totally a problem. So, Luckily, how
that usually manifests in my games is like I have some thematic explanation for how things work, and I expect people to use that thematic idea to be part of their decision making process, and then they don't because the rules didn't say they had to. And so I'm like, well, why would you do that? But it's like the starvation strategy in Stone Age. It's just like, why would you let your people starve? Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I showed up to a Protospiel Milwaukee. I showed up with this game, and I met this group of great guys from Madison, and we had lunch together and everything. It was really awesome. Like, well, we want to play your game. And okay. So it was the first time we had tested it that weekend, and I had all these new great ideas, and I sat down to play it, and it was like turn three. I'm like, all right, guys, I'm done with this. This is just stupid. And they're like, no, we want to keep playing. I like this. I'm like, no, this is terrible. Like, I don't ever want to play this again. I want to throw this away. That idea that I had that I thought was brilliant was absolutely stupid. And they're like, no, I really want to keep going. Like, no, you don't. I promise you. You don't want to keep going. It doesn't get any better.
Ask my wife how many times I've said I've got a great idea for a game, and then we sit down to play it, and like two turns in, I'm like, I want to throw this in the trash right now. Like every two games that I make, just one that's just straight in the trash.
Yeah. And there's only so many times that you can convince your spouse to test it again.
Yeah, hey, right.
I've got this other great idea. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I definitely think that that wives, from what I've heard, are the unsung heroes of game design.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Without Jamie, she lets me, she gives me that like freedom to kind of explore what it is I'm attempting to do, but she also has the sanity to tell me to stop. That's really important.
Yeah, definitely important. My wife is an artist, and one of the things that she tells me, like, whenever I'm frustrated about a game design, she says, just always remember that to make one good piece of art, you need to make 100 bad pieces of art. And so I keep telling her, I'm like, well, that means I should have five Absolutely. Good pieces of art by now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, on a related note of just, like, weird random ideas, whenever you're, like, say for example, this is one of those things, a while back, I had this idea of a reverse drafting game. So like the reverse of Seven Wonders, where in Seven Wonders you start off with a hand of cards and you draft one and put it down, you add it to your collection, and you pass the hand along, and gradually this collection builds and it gives you scoring, whatever. The loose idea was that you start off with a collection of cards and you're trying to shed that collection. You're trying to take one out of your collection, add it to your hand, pass that over to the next player. And by some rule, if you're not legally allowed to add another card to the hand that you've been dealt, then you must take that hand and bank it, and you're trying, and that's a penalty. And you're trying to not get hands, and you're trying to just get as few cards as possible by the end of this thing. And the theme originally that I had was like, oh, it's a tornado. It's spinning around the whole table, picking up things and randomly dropping debris onto people's houses. That's an awful idea. I don't want to make a game about that. Do you ever run into that situation where, like, you come up with an idea for a game, and you just have, like, you think it's a cool idea in theory, but you just don't want to make it?
That's, every day.
Yeah. That interestingly segues into my meth-dealing Breaking Bad board game idea. I love Breaking
Instant
Bad.
Win. Why is that not on Kickstarter? That's a $100,000 game right there.
I can't stop thinking about making this as a deck building game where you're building up your capability to make better and better meth. And if you can hit the blue meth, then you can get on the Middle Eastern the Middle Eastern Europe market. But
brilliant.
License is a problem at that point. And also, oh no.
That's great. Hey guys, we're running out of time here. I think on the subject of meth, we should probably call it. So I don't know if you guys want to kind of throw out one last, maybe to any of the people who are watching right now, want to kind of throw out one last little piece of advice for any designers out there. What advice would you give to a game designer who's trying to get his first game working? You know, Tori, let's start with you.
All right. My advice goes like this. Know the games that are already out there. Learn from their mistakes. Learn from their successes. You don't want to reinvent the wheel, but you don't want to make a design that's already been done. So you don't want to take, you know, say, hey, this great game. Well, yeah, that's Puerto Rico. Everybody used to play Puerto Rico already. You want to know what's out there to know that you're not just redoing something that already exists, and also just to see, you know, what works. What do people like? What is an idea that hasn't been explored yet? Knowing that there's a vast catalog of games out there, and knowing what's key in there, I think can be really useful.
Great. Daniel, how about yourself?
Don't worry about someone stealing your idea. I get a lot of people asking me, because I blog a lot, aren't you afraid someone's going to steal your idea? And I always tell them no. And I tell everyone to not be afraid of that, because that mindset leads you to a situation where you work on something in private, in your own head, in your own little notebook, and you never show it to anyone. And when you finally do, get up the gumption to show someone, it just doesn't work, and you've spent how long working on that in private? So I actively encourage people to get whatever it is they're working on the table ASAP. And if you feel comfortable enough, ask a stranger at the board game at the game shop that's local to you. If you're a little bit shy, talk to someone. Then bring it to someone who actually is family. And I don't think it's a bad thing. Susan McKinley Ross just gave this advice actually on Board Game University. She's the designer of Quirkle and a Spiel des Jahres winner. I think a little bit more qualified than I am to give advice on this kind of stuff. And she says, go ahead, play with your mom, play with your family, and because sometimes it's useful to get a loving opinion first off when your game is still so nascent that it can't really survive on its own in the wild. So yes, get it on the table, regardless, whoever it is, whatever their relation to you, get it on the table, play it, and yes, that's it. That's my advice.
Great. Chevy?
Last time I talked about failing, and I love to give the advice to fail every single day, because you're going to learn a heck of a lot more from your failures than you ever will your successes. But I never went to explain that process, and so I'm going to share something that I shared at Gen Con this week, and that is the idea box. Have an idea box. This is my idea box. It's literally a box that I carry with me that contains things like blank poker cards, Sharpies of all sorts of different colors. I've got dice in here. I've got pawns. I have little wooden cubes. I've got just chits of paper. I've got dominoes. Whatever it is, prototype every single day. If you have an idea, pull out your idea box and just give it a shot. If you've ever thought about writing, a lot of writers will tell you to carry around index cards or a small Molex and or Moleskin notebook and write down character ideas, plot ideas, stuff like that. It's the same thing with any creative endeavor. If you're going to get good at it, you have to do it every single day. Prototype every single day and throw it away when you're done. It doesn't matter if it wins or if it loses or if it's a complete absolute failure. That's probably better for you than if it's awesome. But if it is awesome, continue forward with it. So carry around your idea box and put ideas in it and make ideas come out of it and see what happens.
That's great advice. All right. On that note, I just want to kind of flash my my prototype that I did today. while sitting there at the Grand Con
yes.
today, awesome. I was working out a game idea, just drawn on the backs of cards, you know. Just let's see. There's
Absolutely.
An ant for you. You know, it was just fun to just try an idea with whatever I had at my hands, and that was fantastic. So, cool.
Absolutely. And like we said at Gen Con, Phase 10 decks. Buy every Phase 10 deck you come across. You will use them for every prototype ever.
Yeah. Cool.
Sorry.
All right, well,
had to throw that in there.
That's great. Thanks so much for hanging out with us, guys. We really, really appreciate it. Tori Niemann, where can we find you?
I'm not going to give up my home address. Is that a thing?
On the internet.
my Twitter handle is below. I don't have a website just because I'm just a guy. But yeah, follow me on Twitter. I don't tweet that much, but if people follow me, maybe I will. That's where you can find me.
Great. And Daniel, you're at danielsolis.com.
Yes, I'm at danielsolis.com and also on Twitter at danielsolis, where I probably tweet too much.
I sometimes call your tweets soulless spam.
Yeah.
No offense.
No. I understand because like I really wonder how I have any followers left.
I'm not going to lie, Daniel, there are days when I unfollow you for like 10, 15 minutes, and then I refollow you again, so.
I totally understand.
Hey, Daniel, don't forget to mention your Kickstarter, which is still going for 2 more hours, and it needs help. It's barely funded at 308%, so.
Yeah, it's plug just, yourself there.
It's just crawling to the
floor. I know, I mean, 1,500 backers, what a joke.
It's no Alien Frontiers.
Cool. And finally, Chevy, where can we find you?
ChevyDodd.com or on Twitter, just at ChevyDodd. And here, of course, I should be on this wonderful broadcast most weeks, or most every other, whenever we broadcast.
Every other week, yes.
Right. Every other week. That's what it is. Sorry.
Great. And you can find me and Jason at buildingthegamepodcast.com or btgcoop.com. And thanks for hanging out with us tonight, and we'll see you guys in 2 more weeks. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
It's been a